Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. As a lifelong geek, I will preach the good word of all things niche and nerdy to anyone who will listen, and even some who won't. I'm the kind of person who strongly believes that a good story can change your entire outlook, that a well-crafted game can be a balm for the soul, and that superheroes can actually save you, even if they aren't real. But there are a lot of aspects of geek culture that are still seen as far-fetched, laughable, and even dangerous by certain authority figures, especially when it comes to the field of mental health. Geeks, gamers, and other folks with insular or niche interests oftentimes have to spend time explaining fandom dynamics or the concept of internet friendships, or why they spend so much time reading and writing fanfiction to people who aren't always welcoming. Enter Dr. Megan Connell. She's a licensed psychologist and therapeutic dungeon master with over a decade of experience in the field. She's an incredibly accomplished therapist, educator, author, and content creator in her own right who has turned her attention to creating a safe space for geeks who want to get serious about their mental health in a space tailored for them. She is the author of the upcoming book, Tabletop Role-Playing Therapy. She is a board member for Geek Therapeutics, a training platform that develops professional programs teaching the inclusion of games in clinical practices, and she speaks nationally on the intersection of gaming and psychology and on geek culture. And she's my guest today. Here's Dr. Connell. Dr. Megan Connell, welcome to Head on Fire. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I am so thrilled to speak with you. A listener of mine actually recommended you to me. They're apparently a student of yours. And I was so fascinated by the work that you do. So for folks who haven't heard of you or your platform before, tell people a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do.
Yeah, so I am Dr. Megan Connell. I am the co-founder of HealthQuest Innovative Therapeutics, a whole health mental health facility. Mental health practice, I should say. I'm also the co-founder of Geeks Like Us, a community-based media company. I am the author of Tabletop Role-Playing Therapy. I'm on the board of Geek Therapeutics, where we train psychologists and counselors on how to be trained in using geek and gaming culture in therapy. And I am also in private practice working with geeks and gamers, also trauma, folks with autism. And then I run the live play D&D show called Clinical Role, where I have therapeutic game masters and other psychology types and friends of our show coming on to play with us. I'm the host of the Brain Noodles podcast and the Geeks Like Us podcast. And I do a show called Psychology at the Table for game masters who are wanting to learn how to be more accommodating for players who have struggles such as anxiety, depression, learning disabilities at the table.
You sound busier than me, and I feel like that's hard to do, but you sound much busier than I mean, my gosh, how do you get it all done?
Well, right now, several things are on hiatus while other stuff happens, but it is a lot. I tend to be surrounded by a lot of people who are incredibly busy as well, and high production people, and so that just kind of keeps you motivated when you go and talk to somebody. They're like, well, I finished two chapters today, and they're not reading chapters, they're writing chapters.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
I should maybe do something. So it keeps you motivated.
So what is a therapeutic dungeon master?
Yeah, so this is somebody who utilizes tabletop role-playing games such as Dungeons & Dragons, Kids on Bikes, Emberwind as a tool to use for therapy. Role-playing has been a part of therapy for a very, very long time. In the 1970s, the psychodrama was popularized where you use dramatic play to kind of help embody therapy. And it's incredibly helpful, but the problem is a lot of people don't want to engage in it because we all feel very self-conscious when we are role-playing ourselves. And what tabletop role-playing games do is they give us a character. And as that character, we can role-play and we can experiment and we can try things out. And so playing in the narrative world of the game, it is so incredibly powerful because people get a chance to try stuff without a social cost to it. I'm running a group right now, and we had a session where everybody kind of had analysis paralysis, and then we got to talk about that and talk about how we work through that, but not in terms of the players. It's like, hey, your character really seems stumped and didn't know what to do. What do you think would have helped your character? And when we ask questions in that way, it's this amazing thing because it's no longer about me, the player, and a fault that I have and need to work on. It's my character. And it's that one step removal that really seems to help people engage in the therapy and to be willing to try new things and hear feedback and engage in a different way.
That sounds like it is a lot of prep work. I mean, you must have to have so many pieces to have kind of a really solid foundation for what each person in that group is there to see you for, and then to be mm-hmm. able to set up scenarios that can help them engage with that. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Or? So when we say a lot of prep work, like it is, but not in the way that maybe you're thinking, right?
Okay.
Because in order to be an effective therapeutic game master, what you need to do is you need to be able to be an expert in behavioral therapy. So you have to have advanced training in psychology, social work, counseling, family therapy, et cetera. You need to be an experienced game master, so time running games. And then you need to have a sense of fun and play. And when you can weave those three things together, you become a very effective therapist. For the typical groups in psychology, you're going to have people who have similar problems working together. You know, so like you might have a group for people with ADHD, folks on the autism spectrum. I tend to work a lot on empowerment. And so there's a lot of social anxiety typically in my groups. And so because people typically have a common issue, it's a little bit easier to weave in opportunities for them to practice things. It's like anything with running games. The more you practice it, the better it gets and the easier it gets. I had a session the other week where I had a great plan. Only half my players showed. And I was like, I don't want to advance the plot with only half my players. And so we made something up. We're the two people who are, you know, the couple people who are there. It's like, okay, your characters are going on a side adventure. What are we doing? And we just figured something out, and it's a lot of fun. And it really actually, we found something that hit both of these players' goals of what they were wanting their characters to work on in a really fun and cool way.
I love that. And I'm so fascinated by that. And I'm so fascinated by how, basically how I was introduced to you, that tabletop role playing is such an integral part of your unique experience of therapy that you're able to provide your patients. But when you go to your website, it almost just looks it's still just normal therapy website. Like, you know, we're still going to talk about anxiety and depression and PTSD mm-hmm. and trauma and all of that. So are folks surprised, or, you know, how is that intake process different for you? How is your approach different? What are you offering people that, maybe it's like, well, yeah, sure, okay, I can go anywhere for my anxiety, my depression, my yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. For people who identify as being like a geek or gamer, mm-hmm. I think it's really important to have somebody who understands that culture and having that cultural competency. Like I was fielding a call from a parent who was very concerned about their kid, and they were saying all this stuff. They're like, I forget exactly the things that they were saying they were worried about. And like in my head, I'm going, I think that those are characters from Demon Slayer. And I had to be like, is your kid into anime? And like, yeah, I don't really know what that is, though. I'm like, okay, I think they were writing fan fiction about Demon Slayer. I really don't think you need to be freaking out right now. And like, what's fan fiction? Is this terror? It's like, no, it's not bad. It's okay. I promise. And so being able to kind of de-escalate and demystify that stuff for parents and to, help them with that. But like so many people who are geeks now are, in midlife and beyond. And so just being able to sit down and have those cultural references and have that common language is incredibly important. I'm also a board certified psychologist. Only about 7% of psychologists are, which means after I got my license, I went through additional credentialing because I needed to level up as much as possible. But, you know, it's finding the evidence and it's working with what works. And that's really why I started utilizing tabletop role-playing therapy, because it works. And one of the big things in therapy, it's like, we'll come into therapy and be like, okay, I want to work over here. But really, like, the problem is, you know, deep over in another place. But most of us have adapted to the different problems that we have through creating defensive walls. And so it's anytime like you're working with somebody who maybe has a problem getting close to people, it's like, hey, do you ever think you have some issues with intimacy? It's like, no. And those defensive walls are up and we have all the excuses and all the reasons and the rationales. Something happens when we're playing role-playing games, though. Our stuff comes out. Like, we can try to make a character as different from us as possible, but our stuff is still going to come out. And again, it's that distance. It's not me, it's my character. And so because it's my character, I can see that stuff without the defensive wall. Right. And it's in a way, it is that a big piece of vulnerability that's there. And so that can be really helpful for a lot of people to, you know, sit and to see that and to go, oh, wow, okay, that's something I need to work on. And so a lot of the therapy and a lot of what I do does look like therapy with, you know, a lot of other therapists. The intake's going to be very similar. But like when I'm working with somebody and they're into fantasy, they're into gaming, and they have difficulty with social connections, for my group, I'm like, I think I got a place where you might fit in and something that's going to be incredibly effective for you. And so it's just another tool in the tool chest that we all have.
I really appreciate it. I'm so glad you already brought it up, but I really appreciated how you specifically said, listen, I am very pro-geek. Love a geek, am a geek, very pro geek, and specifically outline things on your website to let prospective folks know I am enthusiastically supportive about your fan fiction, enthusiastically supportive about your anime interests. You specifically also talked about online friendships. You said, you know, other yes. folks may invalidate those. We are going to recognize that those are real friendships. How do you think geek culture, some of these touch points that you've brought up, again, things like online relationships and stuff, how do you think that is treated by the industry as a whole? And how is that different from your approach?
It's a really good question. And I think it's hard. It's something that's developing. And so like our work at HealthQuest, you know, is to promote a lot of these different forms of friendship and connection and building in on those special interests. But also the work that we're doing with Geek Therapeutics to educate other providers on what these things are, because I think it was really interesting to see during the 2020 pandemic that like in 1 week, video games and online communities went from being like how to get your kid out of Discord and into real life to, you know, Discord's a great way for your kid to keep up with all their friends and for you to connect with your friends. It's just, you know, and understanding like,
the sheer volume of people that took up Animal Crossing New Horizons.
Oh my God.
Just so I was one of those people, just so that you could make an island and then go visit your friends on their island. And it was just like, we can't hang out. I can't see you, but I can come to your island.
And we can hang out and we can complain about the raccoon who's, you know, shaking us all down for all of our money. And it's just like demystifying that stuff and trying to help people understand exactly what all of these things are, because so many people just come in and like, you know, a lot of times of people being like, oh, the screens are my problem. And like somebody I was working with was talking about that they're worried they're addicted to screens. And, you know, they're like, I think I just need to get rid of all my screens. And it's like, okay, well, have you ever done that in the past? Like, yeah. So, and there's like, I was like, okay, so when you did it in the past, that got rid of your depression? Like, well, no. Okay. Is it maybe not the screens then? Yeah, it's like, we might need to limit how much we're utilizing the screens, but kind of understanding that like, it's more of a dynamic problem. Like I think social media, gaming, just, you know, YouTube, TikTok, all of that stuff lends itself well to be an easy target for a lot of our problems. And, you know, helping people see the world in a more complicated way, I think, is one of the most important things that we can do just as humans, but also as, you know, mental health providers, you know, to say like, hey, here's different ways to look at things, you know, like, yeah, you can go onto Instagram and you can feel incredible body shame if you're looking at, you know, certain posts. Or you can go onto Instagram and be incredibly motivated to go to the gym, or just, you know, enamored with as many cute red pandas as possible. Like, you know, it's like, it is what you make it. And, you know, helping people to see the world in a more complex way, I think, really helps not just our own mental health, but also like how we bridge and communicate with each other. And so I think that's a big part of geek culture and geek and gaming, is to help people understand this. Unfortunately, like, a lot of the old school, old-timey folks are not as into it. I have not interacted much with the folks at the American Psychological Association, but my understanding is they're kind of like, ugh, when they hear what I do. So, which is fine. I'm just going to keep doing me.
But you do bring up a very good point. Our culture, especially here in the U.S., I can't obviously speak for anywhere else, but really did have a pretty seismic shift to at least there had been a lot of our lives that we were living online, you know, a big piece of our lives that we were sharing through social media, through, gotta upload all those vacation photos to Facebook, and you gotta, you know, you have to interact, you know, you gotta do the birthday post, and you have to do the this and the that. There's a lot of ourselves that we were giving to social media, but then there came a point where we were all kind of forced online and forced into new spaces and forced into this kind of whole new landscape where a lot more of our social interaction, cultural exchange, cultural intake was being done online and through social media. And I still think that we, I mean, obviously, I think we're still kind of in that, and we're still figuring out what that's done to us. But I would like you to expound a bit, because you said that, you know, places like TikTok, Instagram, those kinds of things, because TikTok is obviously under fire. There's a chance that any day now they could ban it. You know, these places make easy targets. I use social media. I'm on social media probably way more than I feel like I should be, but, and I do agree with your point highly that there are some fantastic things that it can do for us. Do you engage at all with some of the, do you think that at least some of the opposition to that has a point?
Oh yeah. Well, like, look, it's really interesting, because I will do talks at different like high schools and middle schools and talking with parents. And I love getting this question of like, what are the good platforms I can let, well, I can feel okay.
There isn't one.
Right. Well, and the thing I answer, I'm like, there's humans on all the platforms.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, you're going to find humans being wonderful to each other and humans being terrible to each other. Like, you know, early Twitter, I loved it. It was so fun. Right.
I pine for what social media was in like 2012. I just really do.
Oh my gosh. It was so fun. I remember like this comic artist I love was drawing a comic, and they had drawn a comic, and Will Wheaton responded to them and was just like, oh my gosh, you are inside my brain. And then the comic writer was like, oh my gosh, you know I exist. And like, I took a screenshot of it, because like, it was so cute. And like, that that's the cool interactions. We don't get that as much anymore, you know, but there are still like really fun things that we can do on social media and to connect. But it's that thing of like, there's people there, and it's how we manage people and how we work with the challenges that we have. And just like, I think one of the things too, though, is what are the expectations? Because like in gaming spaces, we look at, you know, the negative interactions that a lot of people have in, you know, especially like the first person shooter tournament type games, so the trash talking and everything like that. And like, how do we enable better behavior? How do we encourage good sportsmanship and bring that around? And, you know, a lot of that is sort of the create, again, it comes back to culture. What culture are we trying to cultivate in those spaces? And I think like when we don't, the problem with a lot of social media platforms is it's very hands-off. It's like, do what you want with it, kids. Yeah. Right? And then it gets to be very messy. You know, I think like probably the best visual of that would be when Reddit does the, what do they call it? When they have the post where you can click one pixel.
I don't even have a Reddit canvas or something.
I do not even have
a Reddit account. I've never used Reddit.
Oh my gosh.
I am genuinely terrified of Reddit and all of those Reddit and then 4chan and then like just all of those websites where just, I'm terrified. I'm scared.
I'm off Reddit right now because they're doing the blackout because Reddit banned third party like bots and things that were very helpful for moderating different communities and keeping out trolls and stuff.
That's bad.
It's very bad.
That's not good.
I don't want to say it was great, but like there were way easier ways to get to positive communities and communities that were helpful for you in Reddit.
Well, that's good.
Than in other places, I would say. I don't know how it's going to be now after we'll see what the fallout from the blackout is, but every few years Reddit does this thing where they basically release a large white canvas.
Okay.
And every Reddit user once per minute can place one pixel on the canvas. And the different subreddits get together to try and claim areas and make art. And you build in and like you can come in and try to, you can, you know, put a pixel in to wreck someone's art or you can try to save someone's art. And it's really cool to see because like it starts off as pure chaos, but then over the course of several days, like there will be these little pockets of, you know, cool art that's made over, you know, hundreds of pixels because it's people working together around the world to protect their little corner of the Reddit canvas and to do that. And so like, oh yeah, did you find an image of it?
Somebody made a Mona Lisa.
Yes.
These are crazy. Wow. That is intense. That's neat. And it's one pixel at a time?
Yes. Yeah. Every Reddit user can do one pixel once a minute or once every 30 seconds.
That is a lot of people.
It is. And I think like that's such a great visual representation, though, of like kind of what can happen with the internet, where you can have corners of it that are beautiful and well organized and well policed, but then other corners of it that are just chaos. And, you know, so it's how do we cultivate those communities and how do we cultivate, you know, that place where people can express themselves and we can have talks where we don't just tear each other down and we listen and learn and grow. It's hard, you know, and to kind of circle back to like the Dungeons and Dragons stuff, like one of the real amazing benefits from playing games like D&D, a Pathfinder, whatever Cobalt Press's one is going to be, I can't remember what they called Project Black Flag in the end, but is we learn conflict resolution because oftentimes our characters are going to be in conflict with one another. They're not going to agree on what the next objective is, and the players have to talk both in and out of character on what they want to do. The Satanic Panic was so tragic. So for those who don't know, bless you for not knowing.
Oh, believe me, listeners of this show know the Satanic Panic well. I've written on it in books, and I've had a number of we had a number of scholars in the last couple of years.
I mean, the thing for me is doing the research for tabletop role playing therapy because, like, it kills me. It's like this is such a powerful tool and it is such an easy bridge between psychodrama, play therapy, traditional therapy, and an effective outcome. Why has nobody done this before? Not to say like I'm the first to do it. Like there's a cohort of us that have been doing it for about the same period of time. We all kind of started around the same time. But what I found was that in the early 1980s, there were pilot studies that were happening. And there was this fascinating one done with, it was a community center for at-risk youth in New York. And this guy was running a D&D group. And what he found was the kids who played D&D had all these interpersonal skill gains that other kids at the center were not getting. They learned how to talk it out when they had a disagreement with people. One of the things they were saying was that they knew they needed a diverse group of friends because a diverse party was much more effective than a mono party. And just all of these skills that they learned. And this person was like, I think this could be a therapeutic intervention. I think there's all this stuff we could do. That study was published in 1986. And so nobody applied for grants, I think, because they got scared off because of the pushback of it. And it's just tragic.
Well, there's a lot of research from that period of time that didn't get to happen and that we're still feeling the ramifications of. I am curious because I've talked to a few different therapists for the show and then just in other research that I've done. And specifically in regards to, you know, online communication, which is something that you enthusiastically embrace. And they're always talking about it seemingly from like an outsider's perspective, from somebody that's like, I get it. I read a book and I went to a class and I get it. I am here, home dog. So I'm curious because I've heard their perspective. I'd love yours on topics of things like navigating parasocial relationships, because, you know, that world of fan fiction, that world of online gaming, that world of, you know, online interaction in some of these niche communities. I talked to the researcher Sam Aburame earlier this year, who talked about, you know, kind of the cult-like behaviors that can run throughout fan fiction communities. So I'm curious your take on kind of that intersection of, because you're dealing with people in real life. I mean, I know that you do televisits and stuff as well, but you're dealing with folks in real life. You know, Sam's a researcher of sort of online communities. You're dealing with the real people on the other end of the screen. Mm-hmm. Have you dealt with issues of parasocial relationships? Have you dealt with some of those kinds of darker sides of that online world?
Yeah, I think, like, interestingly, like in Geeks Like Us, we've dealt with it a few times. So one of the big things for Geeks Like Us that is very, very important to all myself and the other co-founders and the folks who are what we call our roundtable, so our advisory committee, is to be a autism-friendly community. And like, what I find that's fascinating is a lot of different communities out there will say we are autism friendly, but then somebody with autism comes in and does something that from a neurotypical standpoint is a social digression and like push a boundary in a way that's inappropriate, but is completely understandable from their diagnoses. And it is straight from not understanding the social cues, and they get banned. Like, we've seen this several times where we've had people who come into our community, they've been banned, and other ones are like, I don't want to get banned. I don't really understand why I keep getting banned. What's going on? And, you know, a lot of it is like the parasocial stuff where they'll have wonderful chats with people on Discord, but not understand that, like, that's not a real, that hasn't developed into that deeper friendship, right? It's that acquaintanceship online and that kinship online that you can have that starts, that is the, you know, place where a friendship can bloom from, but it's not a friendship yet. And, you know, not understanding the cues of, like, you know, I'm very good friends with lots of the people that I stream with. And so, like, we have language with each other that is different than I have with people who are watching the shows and are part of the community. And, you know, having to sit down and talk through this with them, I mean, like, you know, this is a parasocial, what you're talking about, this is parasocial right now. Like, you watch me, you understand a lot about my personality, you enjoy watching us, but you don't know us in that way. Like, you haven't seen me on a bad day. you haven't, you know, seen me before I've had my cup of coffee and all that kind of stuff, right?
You haven't seen me when Grubhub messed up my order or delivered it to the wrong house.
Yep. Or just, you know, my favorite of, you know, cooking something and then pulling it out of the microwave, you know, heating it up out of the microwave and it's too hot. And you and that lovely, lovely reaction that we have that preserves our hands from getting burnt.
And then it goes everywhere.
Yeah. And then the dog's eating it. And it's like, well, All right. I guess it's crackers tonight. Yeah. You know, and helping to see that complexity. Because again, like, I think where a lot of the problems come from is we just kind of simply use a ban hammer, right? We just simply like, nope, ban, block, get out, right? And like, and like, look, there are many times where that's appropriate. And like, in even in geeks like us, when people have pushed those boundaries, we've had to like do, we talk to people, we're like, hey, you know, this and this and this were wrong for these reasons. Because of that, you're getting a 30-day cooldown. Like, you know, and like, you can, and here's the conditions you need to meet to become able to reconnect with the community and to come back in. And that's worked really well. In individual practice, like in therapy, when I have folks who are kind of doing that, you know, I the thing I find most helpful is to remind people that people are people. and usually how I end up talking about this is in terms of relationships. And so like, it's interesting because we'll talk about relationships and I'll say like, okay, so like when you start dating somebody, you have this, you know, the honeymoon phase. It's like, or as I prefer to call it, they don't poop phase. It's like, this person is so perfect, they don't even poop. Right. And then like when that wears off, it's like, oh no, they are human. And that's when we can start to see their flaws and their idiosyncrasies and kind of helping people understand that our brain just wants to latch onto the stuff we love and the good stuff for as long as possible. And just, but that's not, we're not seeing the whole picture and, you know, learning to take that breath to see the whole picture. As part of like my practice, I love to bring in media examples. I'm a big fan of John Green's writing, and I think he does a really, really good job of talking about how to see people as complex in his book, Paper Towns. And it's one that I bring in a lot to talk to people about.
That was such a bad adaptation. That was such a bad movie.
I haven't seen it.
Not good. It's a bad movie. And I could tell that there was something underneath it. And I was just like, I don't know what that book was about, but it wasn't whatever this movie was. I hope not. I feel like he's a much better writer than that. That's, yeah.
No, the book, I don't know how they would adapt that into a movie, honestly. Because like, I'm going to paraphrase this section. It's very bad. It's like towards the last quarter of the book. But there's this one point when this character is like, why do we hang out with this guy? He's an asshole. And or am I allowed to swear on the podcast? I'm sorry.
Of course. Yes. Yes.
Okay. And the other friend's like, well, yeah, but he's fun. He's funny. That's why we hang out with him. It's like, that's not a really good reason. It's like, look, dude, you're late to everything. And I'm obsessed with Wikipedia. Like, you guys accept me for who I am, and I accept you all for who you are. Like, yeah, this guy's an asshole at times, but that's okay because he's really funny and he's there for us when we need him. Like, you're always late, but you do show up, you know, and it was this cool moment of like, oh, shoot, you really see me, man. Like, you see who I am. You see who I'm like, you see the facade I'm trying to put up, but you can see beyond it and really see me. And it's okay to be complex. It's okay to be a difficult, you know, a different kind of person. And it's interesting when we start thinking about that, like, I certainly have a number of clients who've, you know, said like, oh, I would love to be a famous TikToker. I'd love to be famous. And
you don't want to, I promise. It's nothing. It's really nothing. It's not a thing. It's really,
it's so interesting though, because when I talk about, it's like, oh, who's a famous actor that you like? And unfortunately, more and more now they're saying a name that I don't know who it is. And I'm like, great, I've hit that age. That's fun.
I did one of those little games where you're sitting at a table and it spins and it shows you all the different celebrities that are also sitting at your table, and it's a game, it's a filter. And I was like, I don't know any. These are not celebrities. You cannot you cannot tell me that these people are celebrities, because they are not. They are not. I've never seen these faces in my life. So I am reaching an age where I am no longer the target demographic.
Yeah. It's a weird time.
It's a weird time. When I'm like, these are not celebrities. Oh yeah, they have 75 million followers and they had four movies last year. There is no way. There is no way. Tell me their name right now.
Yeah. No, that happens. But like, it's interesting when you say to this person, like, okay, so imagine that person leaving their house to go to get a Starbucks. What happens? Mm-hmm. And well, they're swarmed by fans and people. And like, how would you feel like if every day when you walked out of your house, people were following you, taking your picture, asking for your autograph, wanting to talk with you, wanting to fight you? And, you know, pretty quickly, they're like, oh, God, that sounds awful. It's like, yeah, it's... you know, and it's just that thing of like helping people to see the complexity behind things. Like, it's interesting. Not as many people are wanting to be like YouTube gamers and stuff anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. At least I haven't been hearing that one in, as much. But like, I used to watch the Yogscast all the time. And I sat down and tried to figure out like how much they were having to work to put out the content that they were putting out. And it was like 60 hours a week.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah. And you're kind of realizing it's like, well, shoot, they're making really good money, but they're also working their butts off.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think people quite realize. And there's this mystique to creating content online, because all you ever mm-hmm. see is the finished product. And even if you're seeing a behind the scenes, you're seeing an edited version of the behind the scenes. Like, you're not seeing mm-hmm. the hours and hours and hours it took. Or maybe it does take somebody an hour to put together 20 minutes of content. I mean, maybe they're able to just slap it together and do all of that, but you were not there for the 10 years that it took them to be able to put that together in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And all of the many, many, many hours that it took for them to get that good.
Exactly. And that's the thing that for, you know, it's just so much is like, I keep trying, like I keep starting and stopping season 3 of Psychology at the Table because like I don't like video editing. I've through producing a lot of content, I've realized this now. I do have somebody who edits for me, but like then it's also I got to set up. I got to record.
Oh, talk dirty to me about editors. I love an editor. We love editors.
Editors is just, we love them so much. No, I love podcasting. I love doing this, like getting to sit down and talk with people, but then going through and editing the audio and putting that together. Now, like we'll say, I guess like us, our community manager edits our audio. I love her. She's amazing. But like it's so hard because there's great ideas. Lots of people have great ideas, but then getting that idea all the way through to production is really challenging. And, you know, you don't see the work that goes into it. And so that can be such a valuable tool for people. And again, like, it's really interesting to see the conversation from like the family's perspective and then from my perspective. So like, you know, teenagers, like I want to, you know, do, you know, so say it is that they want to do YouTube gaming and their family's like, that's an unreasonable, this is a blah, blah, blah. And they're like, well, no, I see this person doing this person doing it. I've started streaming on Twitch. I have this many followers. I've gotten tips. I've gotten this. And then, and they can, you know, they're getting some success and their parents are telling them it's going to be nothing but failure. And then they come in and like see someone like me and it's like, well, okay, here's the path to success with that. Here's what the work looks like. Here's what you would actually have to do. And then it's like, that's a lot. It's like, yeah, you could do it. But do you want to like really put in all that work? You know, so it's a lot of work.
and the other jobs that you have to support yourself mm-hmm. while you're building that base so that you can eventually support yourself full time doing that. That's the part that a lot of people leave out where it's like, well, either you need somebody. And that's true for a lot of creative fields. I'm an author as well. And it's, you know, I still have to have a day job because I'm real close to being able to support myself, but I'm not there yet. So I still gotta pay the bills. It's just all left out that the creative process, you still have to pay those bills until you can pay mm-hmm. your own bills your own way with your own thing. I'm so curious because I so rarely get to talk to an expert who is so ingrained in some of these spaces. So you manage online communities. You are in online communities yourself. You obviously work with a lot of young people. Armchair psychology and mm-hmm. the use and misuse of various pretty serious psychological terms is all over social media right now. I mean, it's pretty rampant. And I've read a number of papers. I'm not going to ask you to comment on other people's research because that's not fair, because I didn't send it to you beforehand and I'm not here to quote it. But, you know, where clinicians are seeing kind of a pretty major uptick in young folks coming in saying that they feel like they have certain kinds of mental illness, that they are actually developing certain kinds of tics, certain kinds of things that they did not have, that they should not have otherwise, because they've seen it so much on social media. They'll go down a rabbit hole of Tourette syndrome videos from people, and they will actually develop tics from watching it. The words gaslighting, the words trauma, the words PTSD, the words, you know, all sorts of things are just bandied about, and the actual meaning behind them, the punch behind them, is, seems to be removed. How aware are you of this? Do you do any work to help people kind of unwind some of that? And do you have any thoughts, generally speaking, about what this is doing to our ability to effectively communicate mental health needs?
Yeah, great question. It's a great topic. Like, it is a problem. It's interesting, though. I've seen... So my business partner, Dr. Ryan Kelly, like, he seems to get a lot more of the folks who are giving themselves kind of big labels off of stuff that they're seeing on social media. I think because one of my specialties is autism in women and girls, that's the community that I'm seeing a lot of. And interestingly, it is usually a lot of mid-20s to all the way up to 50s women who are coming in and be like, I've been getting all these recommendations for videos on TikTok or YouTube about autism in women, and I feel like I'm being seen for the first time. And going through and doing screenings and evaluation, a lot of them do seem to be on the spectrum. And so, like, on the one, like, again, to go back to internet can be good and bad, right? On the one hand, it's so amazing because, you know, the diagnostics for autism are based off the presentation of white males. That's, I don't know another nice way to say that. And so, we're understanding more and more that autism presents slightly differently in females. There's a lot of overlap, but women are socialized differently than men. So when I'm saying women too, it is people who are identifying female, presenting female. So if you look and, you know, are perceived by others as a female, you are treated differently than if you look or are perceived as male, both in writing. So just in text-based stuff, there's lots of research on that, and then face-to-face as well. And so because of that, like, it is bringing more people to see themselves in that and to accept that and to learn about themselves. It's very interesting because, like, I will tell everybody, like, I have a very love-hate relationship with diagnostics. Like, on the one hand, it's very helpful and it can be very useful to kind of finally have that label and to know what's going on. But on the other hand, there's something called diagnosis threat. And what that means is when you are given a label, you're going to go home and you're going to research this label. And you're going to make sure you fit the label. Like, for depression, there's 9 basic symptoms of depression. I think you only need 5 of the 9 to be diagnosed with it. So you might only have 5 of 9 symptoms, but you go home and you read the other 4 and you're going to start manifesting them.
Oh, sure.
Right.
Sure.
And, like, you know, part of our ethics with this, you know, we're following the Hippocratic Oath of, like, do no harm. If we give somebody a label and they are developing pathology that they didn't have before they knew that label, that's harm, right? I don't know another way to see it. And, like, there is good that comes from understanding your brain and understanding you, but, like, we don't want to do harm. And so, like, when I'm talking, especially, I'm going to couch this more on the autism side because that's what I see a lot.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I'll talk about it in terms of, like, look, your brain might be slightly on the spectrum. And if it is, these are some challenges we could expect. Here's how we overcome those challenges. You know, autism looks different in everybody. This is why we have moved from a just categorical, like, yes, you have this, to spectrum with pretty much every diagnosis across the board. It is a spectrum. It's, are you a little bit? Are you moderate? Are you a lot? And kind of understanding what that looks like. You know, some people who are on the spectrum can do very well learning how to read social cues, and they're good at that, but they're terrible at modulating their tone. Other people are great at masking their tone, but can't read social cues to save their life. And so it's just kind of understanding, like, it's not so much going, ah, this is true about me, and therefore I can do whatever. It's like, okay, this might be part of how my brain works if I know that these are some things I'm going to struggle with. And it really comes back to that, like, learning self-acceptance and understanding where we're strong, where we're weak, what we're good at, what we're not so good at.
So it sounds like self-diagnosis, and that's the term that I hear a lot, is self-diagnosis. Self-diagnosis is valid. Self-diagnosis, and a lot of that is couched in how expensive, how lengthy, how difficult the process of going through somebody, a professional like you, for a diagnosis can be. So self-diagnosis is a big deal in online communities and online spaces, but it also sounds like self-misdiagnosis could lead you to either begin presenting symptoms that you did not otherwise have, or convince yourself that you have these symptoms that you may not have. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's very fair to say. And, you know, the problem with getting assessed and getting diagnosed and all of this stuff, it is painful. It is difficult. I was just talking with somebody today. Insurance companies won't cover it.
Yeah.
There's no medical need for this. It's like, well, how about there's something weird going on and we want to understand it? Let's run a test. But, you know, I'll go slightly political here. If we could get some universal healthcare going, that might cover assessment and stuff.
The fact that that would even be a political conversation, it's weird and dumb.
it's weird. It's like, hey, like, we should be able to understand what's going on with our brains, please.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
we can barely get healthcare with our big crappy insurance system, but mental healthcare is far and away even worse. It's even more inaccessible.
If anybody watches Last Week Tonight, John Oliver actually did a really awesome piece on insurance and mental health care and why so many of us don't accept insurance. This is on my website. Like, I don't accept insurance. I'm not hiding that fact. And I'm unapologetic about it, because when I did, I had this very uncomfortable realization that the insurance companies read your notes. And so I'm writing about notes, recording work on people's trauma, depression, childhood issues, insecurities. I don't know who's reading that, and what are they going to do with that information? That really made me uncomfortable as a professional. And so I am very protective of my notes and of my clients. Like, this is a sacred space. We are working hard on difficult things that you're not wanting to bring out there. We're dealing with them in here. And what's in here does not need to be read about by people who aren't in here, unless it's medically necessary. So
are there ways for people for whom, I mean, obviously, if insurance isn't something that can be taken, are there ways for people to get help if finances are a hurdle?
A lot of insurance companies will do reimbursement for out of network. And so, like, asking your insurance company and finding out. Also, it doesn't hurt to apply to see if you can get that provider to be considered in network. So you get actually reimbursed at a higher rate you still have to pay out of pocket for the sessions. But you can get reimbursed a decent amount. Like, we've seen this before where people were like, oh man, I don't think you're going to get approved to see me, like, and get any reimbursement. You're just going to be kind of, it'll count towards your deductible. But then they do. You know, so it's just, it really depends on the insurance company. A lot of providers will do sliding scale. They might limit how many sessions they'll do with you. So you really got to be ready to get in there and work. But that's something, and you can ask for that. But also, if you are open to telehealth, for psychologists, we have something called the PsyPact, which COVID, one of the good things that came out of this was it pushed a lot of states into the PsyPact. And so what it is, it's an agreement between states to recognize one another's licenses for telehealth services.
Oh, wow.
And so by August 2nd, between states and territories, my license that I have is going to be accepted in 45 different places.
Oh, that's amazing.
So if you live in one of those 45 places.
I'm going to switch my provider
places,
to you. We're going to have sessions down again. I want to come to a D&D game.
Yeah. But like that's so powerful because like, so if you live like, say, in Chicago and, it's, you know, it's really expensive to see a therapist in Chicago, right? Like you might be able to find somebody in, I'm trying to think of like more, maybe in Nevada, who has a low, because their cost of living is lower, so their rates are lower, but who also specializes in what you need and your personality jives well with, you know? And so like it enables you to really shop the market and to widen your search to almost the entire country. I find it fascinating that it's, we're going to have, it's North Dakota, Oregon, California, Hawaii, Alaska, Mississippi, and Louisiana, I think are going to looking like going to be the only states that are not, oh, and maybe Indiana are going to be the only states.
Of course,
not
Indiana. Of course, Indiana.
but all the, like, even New York has legislation in to join it now, which is huge.
That's amazing. That's huge.
And Massachusetts too. So once New York and Massachusetts join, the entire Eastern Seaboard is going to be part of this, you know, and so again, for people who are living in, once New York joins, cause I think they're going to, if you live in New York City and you can't afford New York City therapist prices, like you're going to be able to shop like, you know,
so
most
great.
Of the country.
Oh, that's fantastic. And then, you know, if you're a busy person or you have in-person anxiety or something like that, just being able to do a session. Now, I will say the telehealth does start to have crossover with some of those apps that are on a whole, that are advertised in a lot of podcasts that I feel like a lot of clinicians have some feelings about, places like BetterHelp or something.
BetterHelp and all those places. Yeah. And, you know, no trash to any clinicians who are on BetterHelp and all these other ones, but like it's this weird umbrella. And like, you're paying to BetterHelp and BetterHelp pays to the clinician, you know, they're subletting out. I feel much better going and just finding the person, you know, it's sort of like the, you know, this place, it's like, oh, we'll pair you up with a teacher, you know, for learning an instrument. And then you meet the person. It's like, okay, you're cool. Can I just hire you and just cut out this middleman who's going to take way too much money from you?
Yeah, it's expensive. Those are, I looked into it during COVID when I was looking for a new therapist. It's expensive. And all those like online, you know, podcast little coupons they give you, it's still expensive. 20% off of expensive is still expensive.
It is. And so like, you know, again, having that ability to go across state lines, like it does involve a lot more research, but like, you know, kind of knowing keywords to look for, there's a few different places where providers advertise. Now we have to pay to advertise, which is its own thing. But like reach out, you know, like if you've heard a provider who's on a podcast like this, who, you know, is talking about stuff, you're like, oh my gosh, I think what they're talking about, like, I would love to work with a therapist who actually really understands fan fiction and can talk about that, because like, that's how I have my creative outlet. And my last therapist was shaming me for it, thinking I was just like into kinky stuff, you know, like reach out, like, you know, these communities they're rather small. Well, we know each other, you know, and it's like something that I have figured out, you know, and I think you've probably figured it out too in the professional space, is like, you just ask.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's so amazing when you just reach out to somebody and you're like, hey, would you be able to help me with this? Or would you be interested in chatting about this thing? And so many people are willing to say like, yeah, sure, let's talk. And it's great.
I would be a terrible geek if I did not ask the geeky questions, because there's going to be people that have tuned into this episode and said, where the hell is all the D&D talk? So I'm going to ask as many granular D&D questions as I can. Now, all of that said, I have never actually played the game. I know. I've wanted to for years. I just don't have any friends that also want to play this game. So
we've chatted, we've had a wonderful conversation. When I get campaign 2 of Clinical Role going, I will invite you on.
I would love it. Oh my God. Yeah. You would make my gay little heart sing. But I will say I had some listeners. I've asked some listeners for some feedback of what they wanted to know, and it was literally all just gaming questions. So I'm gonna ask you all of their questions so they can feel very happy. Yes. What D&D edition do you use? Apparently, there is a lot of debate as to which edition you should be using. So which one do you use?
I use 5th edition, which is the newest edition right now. The reason for that is several fold. One, it is what I know. And that saves brain power from having to learn a lot of other rule sets. The other thing is a lot of the folks that are in my group struggle with making friends and have, like I said, social anxiety. And my hope is that through learning D&D, they have a tool now to go and make friends, so that when they go off to college, they can join a D&D group, or they can go to a local game store and jump into an Adventure League game, and they're playing 5th edition. And so by knowing the most popular gaming system that's played worldwide, it increases the chances that they're going to be able to find people to game with when they go other places.
I thought this was a really interesting question. Do certain types of people typically choose certain character types?
I'm trying to think. I see more of species, actually, than character types. There seems to be a push for, like, I see a lot more of going less human and more bestial for people who have a hard time connecting.
Really?
So like creating, Tabaxi or the cat people. And then also I have a lot of people who try to make dog people or Hernet, the rabbit people, or Hernet Hernandez, Hernet. I don't know how they're pronounced.
You could literally say anything right now, and I would think you were correct.
Yeah, but it does seem to be a thing of like when you kind of feel a little bit more like an outsider. It seems like they pick those more kind of outlandish species.
That's fascinating. I love that.
So many studies to be done.
Do you have any idea? Does that cross over into their personal lives? Is there some furry fandom going on? Like, does that translate there too, or is that?
I don't know. Okay. Again, really interesting. Like one of my favorite things that my publisher let me do with my tabletop role-playing book is I have an appendix that is nothing but research questions. I'm like, graduate students, please take these questions and run and do research. Make it plentiful. But that would be a fascinating study too of like, where's the crossover? You know, is there a crossover? Uh-huh. And like, if so, what is that? You know, and like, how do we have, you know, open up those, you know, communication lines and think about those things. Because again, people
aren't
want
playing
to just
elves anymore. I thought elves were a big thing.
Oh no,
still.
Elves are still super popular.
Oh,
no,
good.
No, definitely. No, everybody wants to be the hot elf. That is another thing.
Okay. This one, I don't quite understand. I'm assuming you do though. Do you use pre-existing modules or a homebrew?
So a pre-existing module is like a book with an adventure written into it.
Okay.
And that you run through. Homebrew is where you make it up as you go. I used to use more modules, but I have since kind of abandoned that and I make my own stuff. I steal a lot of stuff from modules, but I pretty much will make up, and there are big air quotes around that, depending on the group. Like the group I'm with right now, that it just happened, kind of the story that they kind of landed on really fit with Aaron Morgenstein's The Starless Sea, and none of them have read it. And so I have been
recommended that book so many times, and I still have not read it. I'm sure I liked her other one. Erin Morgenstern, that she did the Night Circus, right?
Night Circus, yes. Yeah, oh my God, Starless Sea is so good. Such a good book. But yeah, I'm getting to steal that liberally for this campaign and build into it. But also, like, it's cool because when you take the inspiration from something, you can change it and modify it to meet the needs of your players. When you're using a module, it's a little harder because, like, if you forget about introducing a certain NPC or you don't hit a certain story beat, and like the rest, it all kind of falls apart.
What does that session zero look like? How does is it different than a typical session zero because it's therapeutic? Is it
a little bit. So okay. I do, Monty Cook made an amazing free PDF called Consent in Gaming, where they have this wonderful checklist at the end of go, no go topics where you can do a light system. So green is I'm fine with this. Yellow is happen off screen, not too much on. And red is like, this is a hard pass. And so we go over those topics. We talk about that. I have safety tools that I utilize. I call them dynamic safety tools. So it expands on the X card and lines and veils. So we make the lines and veils through the light system with the go and no-go topics. But then we also use these chips. And so a little yellow happy face, if I do a vibe check and people are feeling good, they can throw that in. I've got a little meh face of like, we're nearing a line. We're not across it yet, but I'm not loving it. We have a red X for we need to stop. This is bad for me. And then a blue pause button for I'm confused. I need a rule clarification. I don't know what's going on right now.
Give me all the blue chips. I would be so lost.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I listen to a lot of playthrough D&D podcasts. I feel like I wouldn't be terribly lost, but I would need a few blue chips.
Yeah. Yeah. So we go over that stuff. And then I do talk about what we're trying to do with therapy and how the therapy is getting woven in and how we're going to have process discussions and talk through all of that. So, yeah, I think that's, it's very similar. Like, I think it's interesting because so much of therapeutic games looks very similar to games as usual. But there are these moments where it stops and we talk about really heavy emotions and we're talking about our personal stuff and how to connect that stuff with what we're doing. And it's fascinating to see the growth and development that happens through playing.
So are these one shot sessions or are these like arcs or?
I do 10 week groups. Okay. So week one is session zero. And then we do 10 or 9 games. It's a mini campaign essentially. And then players, if they come back to another group, they can bring their same character at the same level. And we kind of go from there.
Do you have any requirement to see people outside of group session as well? So that it's not just Kelly, yeah. The orc admitted to some tough stuff. Oh no, Kelly, the orc, like maybe we need to talk to Kelly, the person too.
Yeah, I meet with everybody one-on-one beforehand to kind of get a feel for, what's going on with them. If I do have any kind of concern where like maybe there's been a lot of, I call it emotional permeability, but the more colloquial term is bleed. I use emotional permeability because writing bleed in my therapy notes would seem terrible. but like where we maybe are over-identifying, we're having a lot going on, and to reach out to the family after and be like, hey, seemed like a lot happened. I'd like to just do a quick one-on-one check-in session with them or something like that.
Well, this has been incredibly fascinating and eye-opening. I am so grateful for your time. I do want to be respectful of your time. For folks, let's go ahead and plug your book, Tabletop Role-Playing Therapy. When's that come out? I'm so excited. W.W. Norton.
Yes, it came out actually on March 28th. So is out. It is in the world.
Of course it did. I'm such a good host of a podcast, I definitely did all that research. Yes.
It's out. It's newly out. It's selling really well. I'm really pleased.
Congratulations on making Oprah's best. Oprah's bestseller, Reese Witherspoon's bestseller.
Yeah.
List. Got it.
I did it. I did it. Like the only academic psychology book. It's actually kind of funny because like a lot of people who want to sell it aren't able to because it's only supposed to be sold in like textbook selling places.
Sure.
But I have a lot of game stores who are like, I want to sell this. I would be able to sell this. Can we please get it? But you can get it through Amazon. You can get Barnes & Noble through friendly local game stores friendly local bookstores and stuff too can order it for you. Like they might not have it on the shelf, but they can order it. If you want to support your local bookstores, please do so. It is also an audiobook. That was a request I had because I have a language-based learning disability. So reading printed books, especially academic books, my brain's like, mm-mm, we don't like this. So through audiobooks.com.
Did you do the narration?
I have dyslexia. Do not make me read out loud and relive all my childhood trauma from third grade.
I know a lot of nonfiction authors do their own narration. I got to narrate my own last audiobook. So
that's awesome. I sort of would love to be able to, but like,
I mean, you've got the same setup. I mean, I had that same microphone when I did it. I did it here in my home office.
No, I what I would love to do. One of my favorite couples therapy authors, what he did instead of reading his audiobook, he talked through the sections of it and just free talked through the concepts. And it was, his book was kind of unreadable, so it was much better in the audio, abridged audio.
Nick Offerman and his wife, who played Karen Walker, and I am forgetting her name right off the top of my head, and that's a bad gay move right there. They did a book together, and it's very, very funny. Their audio book is them not reading it, but it's just them kind of like, okay, this was about, and then they just kind of talk to each other. It was almost like a podcast. Like they just talk to each other about what was in the chapter, and you get all this stuff that they didn't even write in there. And it's very funny. It's the only time I've ever seen like an audiobook that had no relation whatsoever to the actual text. It was great. I loved it.
Oh, that's beautiful. But the audiobook, it's available audiobooks.com. I think you can also get it through libro.fm, which will, again, if you don't know that, for audiobooks, they support a local bookstore. You choose a bookstore that you like to shop at, and your purchase of audiobooks through them the sale is credited to that store.
Yeah, Libro.fm for really audiobooks, cool. And then bookshop.org for physical books, physical and ebooks. You can buy through bookshop.org, and it will let you choose a local bookstore. In fact, if you look up your local indie bookstore, they probably have a bookshop.org link, affiliate link, that you can go through, and then just whatever books you buy, it'll give them a little kickback.
So please do that. Support local bookstores like that. That needs to happen. But yeah, it is out. It's available. I go to different conventions. I'm going to be going to Origins Game Fair as of recording next weekend. And then I'll be at Gamehole Con and PAX Unplugged will be the other conventions I'll be at this year. So I'll probably be touting around a couple copies and sign them if you want me to. I'm trying to do it. I roll dice on the book too before I sign it and put down what number I rolled.
I don't know
what it means, but it's fun.
And if folks want to find you online, where can they do that?
They can go to hqpsych.com. That's the website for my practice, or to megansidey.com. That is my personal webpage.
And all of your various podcasts and stuff, let's just run through them down one last time so that everybody, just in case they didn't take notes.
Yeah, because I actually realized I forgot some.
let's do it. Let's just do it.
if you're interested in the media I create on YouTube and Twitch, Geeks Like Us, the E's are threes because the 90s were cool, man, in geeks.
You're so leet.
Yes. Or the spelling was taken. Whichever one you want to believe is fine. I do Psychology at the Table through there. I do the Geeks Like Us book club where we are reading through Kate Elliott's Crown of Stars series right now. We're getting ready to talk about book six next week. It's a 7-book series, and it's kind of cool because that was the first series that I read that I found an online forum for, and like it's connected to other fans for the first time online through her books. And now like in my online community, I'm getting to promote her books. books, which is kind of fun. I also do the Brain Noodles podcast. It's where myself and other psychological ladies sit around and talk about really important issues like office supplies and what games we're playing and Bluey. it is a lot of fun. Then I do the Geeks Like Us podcast. We're getting ready to start that back up again, probably in September, where we just have different geeks and gamers on and chat about the things that we are unapologetically enthusiastic about and what that means to be unapologetically enthusiastic. I do, again, Clinical Role will be starting back up in September, and that will be fun. It's going to be a what's called a West Marshes style game. So there's going to be a central location that players will come in and out of, but then it will be different groups every like 3 weeks. So when you come on, it's only like a 2 to 3 week commitment. It's not
so
very
excited.
Long.
Oh, yay.
Yeah.
Please keep me in mind. I definitely want to do this.
I will.
Yay.
Yeah. No, we're going to have a large rotating cast. That's what it's just really exciting that people just pop in when they can and then pop out, and it'll be a lot of fun.
So excited. I can't even begin to tell you. Dr. Megan Connell, thank you so much for being here on this episode of Head on Fire. I am so appreciative of your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a great time.
Well, that's going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks once again to Dr. Ashley Brandt. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Please consider sharing it with your friends on social media. Word of mouth is the best and easiest and freest way to help spread the word. Or you could also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you. If you hate the ads at the beginning and end of each episode, consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and little freebies along the way. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Or if you'd like to connect with me on social media, I'm at headonfirepod on TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and whatever new social media they're going to roll out this week. Thanks so much for tuning in and downloading the show. Thanks so much for being here. I'm going to go. But remember, this was not medical advice or opinion, so don't sue me. Be well.